This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas, the show where local voices tell the stories that keep the Central Coast connected. I'm David McAbee. On this week's show, I sit down with Bob Whiteford, one of the owners of Insomniac Video, to talk about the rise and eventual fall of the beloved video store and how he's now teaming up with the Palm Theater to bring back a little movie magic through Insomniac Secret Cinema. Then Gianna Patchen returns with another edition of People and the Planet. She speaks with Sandy Aylesworth and Steph Wald about the Point Sal Marine Protection Program. And finally, Brian Reynolds talks with author and entrepreneur Mike Miner about his new book, Heroes, Rogues, and Wisdom, a 20th Century American Family History. It's about the movies we loved, the places we protect, and the families that keep our stories alive. All coming up on Issues and Ideas.
Hi, I'm Bob Whiteford, formerly of Insomniac Video, now currently of Insomniac Secret Cinema, playing once a month on Thursdays at the world-famous Palm Theater in San Luis Obispo.
And world-famous Bob, thank you for being here on Issues and Ideas with us today.
Well, I don't know about that.
Bob, thank you again for being here with us. Why don't you go ahead and just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Oh, dear. Where do I begin? The story is epic, kind of like a David Lean film. I'm from New York, obviously. Came to the Central Coast after a prolonged losing streak in 1979, landed in Morro Bay, kind of broke out in hives because it was very different from the world I came from, radically different. Everybody's, you know, windsurfing to Christopher Cross, and, you know, I was having my first panic attacks. It was a change. And I'm glad that I stuck it out because it was a change for the better. And during the 80s, I met John Jones from Insomniac fame. I met a lot of guys, the guys from the Trees of Mystery. That was Rob Dubois, J.J. Hollebeck, Mitch Fadum, the late Morris Samuel, and Drew on the Skins, and I was the MC. I kind of cut my teeth on stage. It was a lot of fun. At that juncture, everybody headed north to make a go of it, the band, myself. We landed in San Francisco, where I lived for many years. I worked, believe it or not, I worked at Charles Schwab. Now, I wasn't investing. I was in the back with the kooks in the records department, a group of really fascinating folks, and I learned a lot. It was a really interesting experience in terms of just living life. And to get to the real crux of the matter, the meat of the matter, when I was there, my mother lived down here. She used to work at Ted's and Fred. She was good friends with John Jones and Pat and Mark, all the guys over there. So she was a little bit of a legend in her own right. God bless her. What happened was she got ill. I had to come home on Clinton family leave, which meant you could go home, but you don't get paid. Enough of that. And so I'm here for a few months tending to her. And I realize that probably my job is in jeopardy. And at that point, I don't really care. While I was down here, I went to a wedding at the Cayucas Vets Hall. And it was great. And a mutual friend reintroduced. John and I knew each other from before. And John had this idea for a crazy video store. We talked about it, had a couple of beers. We got a little buzz on, shook hands, and then it just all fell together. You know how it is sometimes, Dave. It's like everything just lines up right. And that was kind of the vibe of the late 90s. It seemed things were kind of open here. there were possibilities. You could start something like Insomniac in a place off on High Street. There was like some old building, and we got in there. And with these old kind of funky spaces, you're not paying a lot of rent, but it also allots you freedom to be creative in those zones. And when it comes to creativity, John is second to none. The thing is, just get out of his way and unleash him. He just is a pretty amazing individual. I mean, of course, I'm biased. I love the guy. And so we were off and running. I had a video collection. He had a video collection. His was more esoteric, if that's the right word. I don't even know if that describes it. But he was into fascinating stuff. He had like William S. Burroughs and all kinds of Polish filmmakers and Sergei Parajandov. You know, I mean, he was way out there. Me, I had your AIP bike movies, and I had, you know, a lot of exploitation, 50s horror, sci-fi, which Bug-Eyed Monsters always plays well, and a good smattering of classic cinema. Believe it or not, I'm pretty well versed in my, you know, David Lean and Marty Scorsese, my God. That was the basis. And then we had another strike of luck. Terry Peterson, who worked at Boo Boo's for many years, was looking to start her own business. And that was called Stufferama. So we teamed up. So it was, you know, basically rent-wise, we could manage. We could make our nut pretty quickly. And an added bonus of having her there was she understood things we didn't. She said, look, get the Jim Carrey movie. And John and I are like, yeah, that guy's... Come on.
It's too commercial.
Yeah, I can't. We can't do this. I can't be seen with this. Get a Disney film or two. And she was right.
That's what brings people into the store, is they're coming to look for Liar Liar. And then they walk out with Harold and Maude or whatever. You know, like, to tell you, that's how I was introduced to Insomniac. Being a teenager in the 90s, growing up in Cayucas, we had Cayucas Video, which was amazing. Between all the movies, the pool table, it had just a little bit of everything. But when I walked into Insomniac the first time, I was like, oh, this is what Cayucas Video is missing. It's everything from Stufforama to the one-of-a-kind Danish black-and-white vampire horror film that nobody ever has ever seen, you know? So, but that's what brought people into that place. It wasn't a blockbuster.
No, not at all.
It was the anti-blockbuster.
Well, you know, the funny thing about that is we had friends that worked at Blockbuster and would come and rent from us. Mm-hmm. And whenever they were selling stuff off that we could use, they would always help us out. We were, again, there's that synchronicity, serendipity, whatever the hell you want to call it. It's like we had friends everywhere. A lot of people were helping us out. The thing was, then, it was finding some of this stuff was very hard. And the versions we came across, because there were copyright issues, some stuff was available in Europe and not here, even though they were American movies. So you had to, not bootlegs per se, we used to call them gray legs, where you could get a film off a Japanese laser disc and it'd be transferred to VHS. They had the same format as us. So you would, like Chimes at Midnight with Orson Welles. You know, it looked great, but it had Japanese subtitles and they run top to bottom. Uh-huh. But we had it. Mm-hmm. And back in, you know, now you could go to YouTube and find a Yugoslav film. In fact, I watched Operation Cross Eagles with Rory Calhoun the other day. Total piece of crap, but very enjoyable.
But you would know to look for that, though. That's kind of what I'm getting to is when myself going to the video store, I didn't know ever what I was looking for. I'm sure I had an idea of something. I wanted to go get Evil Dead or whatever, Hundra. But that would always lead to, wait a minute, what's that one? You pick up the box, you look at the box, the pictures are really cool. It's got some weird, just, oh, you know what, I'll get this too. You'd have to know to look for that on YouTube, and it's highly doubtful that anybody other than maybe yourself and myself, our algorithm is going to pick that up for you. There's something very specific about the human touch when it comes to that kind of stuff.
It's very true. That's a great point, and that's, I think, what we brought to the community. Well, we had a community. It was it was interesting how people would come in looking for one thing, and then they would just kind of hang out and get lost, and we'd have to come out and, you know, talk to them.
Guide them.
What is this? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, that's what we used to call, or what they used to call, what was it? There were these films we got from this filmmaker in the South. And they used to call him the Chitlin Circuit. And it was all these films that played in Southern drive-ins. Please Don't Touch Me, Untamed Mistress. None of them really Academy Award worthy, for sure. And the videos were great because they were shot in kind of a funky, scratchy 16 millimeter, and they maintained that. Mm-hmm. So you're kind of, the experience is you're in a seedy theater in Memphis, and, you know, this film promises, you know, every perversion known to humankind and then some, and delivers nothing, mm-hmm. really. And that was kind of fun, you know, and this was stuff we were learning about as we got in there. We had our basic knowledge, and then you start seeing more and more, and it gets crazier and crazier and crazier and more fun.
There's a way to actually put your hands on those things back then in the 80s, 90s, and into the aughts, is you could touch these things. You could feel it was physical media.
Physical media,
yeah. It used to be a thing. And to me, it's still a very important thing. And which kind of brings me to my next point of, so you're in Insomniac. You guys are rocking and rolling through the 90s into the 2000s. And that's when the script starts to flip a little bit with how people are ingesting media, right?
Correct. And there's no way to get around it. The end for Insomniac came in stages. Initially, when Netflix hit, it wasn't a big thing. But what happened basically was a perfect storm. As I mentioned earlier, our customers were community. And they came from all over the county. We were kind of a destination. We had a guy from Lompoc that was into Anna May Wong films, and we had them. She was a very glamorous, exotic Asian American actress from like the 1930s into the early 1940s. And, we were dealing with this across basically the entire county. Everybody had a certain thing they wanted to see, and we had it. But over time, it was the serendipity in reverse. Mm-hmm. It was, the people, the community, the neighborhood, people started getting married, started having kids. You know, you see the baby strollers, then you don't see them at all. They have to go do what they do. Started seeing that. Then you had the technology. And, you know, suddenly, you know, you could get your films online, either rent them online if you had the gear back then, you could just pull them up. I mean, it was in its infancy, but, you know, what are you going to do? You're in your living room. You don't have to come and be dazzled by us and charmed, of course. It was like the beginning, I think, of people kind of retreating from a social situation, which video stores, all of them were in general, to a more insular lifestyle. That took a little time to take seed in my head. And then there was an economic downturn around 2007 or 8. The bottom fell out of everything. And it was a real struggle to stay open. And then the kiss of death was, you know, I met with the landlords. I was hoping to negotiate a deal to lower the rent. Instead, they upped it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, I guess I'm turning into Kenny Rogers over here. I got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them, know when to hide away and when to run. It was time to run. So it wasn't feasible anymore. I mean, we were in the black after the first year, which tells you something. I mean, modestly. We're not talking, you know.
Sure, it's still a video store at the end of the day. You guys aren't rolling in Bentleys.
No,
we're talking and still VHS rentals at that time.
Yeah,
so
pretty much.
But good in the black. Just not Bentley black. So
Yeah. Could buy a six pack of beer.
That's all you need.
Yeah. Yes, take your gal out to a movie.
Exactly.
Honestly, after a little while, we actually could pay our rent and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It was great. And the fact was we were doing it. But then came the dawn. It was done. And, you know, we had to sell everything off, make sure all our bills were paid because John and I live here. You don't want to walk around and someone say, he stiffed us. And even a sense of like treating somebody wrong will blow back on you. So we got all our bills paid. So we left honorably with our tail. But, you know, I mean, what would the military tactic be? A tactical withdrawal. Mm-hmm. I remember the last moment. Before we locked up, a few days before Halloween 2008. And I know the election was coming sometime afterwards, but it didn't matter. But what happened was I was with my sister, and I was taking out the last bit of stuff that was still there. I was going to throw it out, and it was the cash drawer. And the cash drawer was given to me by Bob O'Brien. He was like a local legend. He had big music. He was like one of my retail gods. And I held that thing, and I just had a moment with it. And I found myself laughing to myself. It was like really funny, all the things that had happened. And there was so much. And then I just took it and threw it in the trash bin and walked away. And I felt pretty good about it. And at that time, I was on the radio here with Jim. We were doing the Take Two show, which was a lot of fun. That became kind of a bittersweet experience for me because I love doing the show. And people would call in. We miss your video store and all this. And I would just come home sometimes feeling a little deflated. But I also knew in the end there wasn't anything I could do.
It's not like you didn't have fun for
11 years.
Yeah, 11 years. It's not like it was a chore to go. I got to go to the video store. It's time to go to Insomniac and talk about cool movies and watch cool stuff and talk to cool people all day.
Yeah.
So when people bring that up, I get it. It hurts.
With all of that, it was a tough period. I got to be honest because the store was done. I was working part-time at Cuesta as an hourly. I was on food stamps. I mean, it was a rough period. Mm-hmm. And I'd show up in social functions and people would say, how do you like retirement? It's like, I'm not retired, you know. And if I have a loaf of French bread and some butter, that gets me through the day. And And I had a little terrier, a little Yorkie named Junior, who's a real hellion, so that helped. And luckily, then there was a new period of serendipity and good fortune. Jim saw my predicament, threw me a bone, got me a job at the Palm. And I got...
What year is this?
Let's see, maybe 2010, about 2 years after Insomniac was done. And I got to hang with the staff there. There was a great bunch of folks there, and had a lot of fun. So it was between what I was getting at Cuesta as an hourly and working part-time at the Palm, suddenly things were stabilizing. And I was in two worlds where I felt pretty comfortable. Mm-hmm. The Palm, I was back in the movie business, and I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed the people I worked with. We had some great conversations, because that's what you do some... Don't tell Jim, but sometimes in between, you get breaks where you can talk. Mm-hmm. And I learned a lot. You know, it's like, it's good to talk to younger people. Hey, old fogies out there, don't fear the youth. Have talks with them. Share your knowledge, and they'll tell you some things that are going on that we wouldn't know. I mean, that's the way it goes, right?
I'll take it a step further and say, why doesn't everyone put down their phones for 5 minutes and talk to somebody?
Amen, David. Uh-oh, I shouldn't have said that. But it's a manner of speaking. I watched too many old Randolph Scott movies. So it worked out. And then over time, I got a full-time gig at Cuesta. And I did my 20. And retired, and I made a whole new bunch of friends, people I know and I love. And so it somehow, you could call it luck, you could call it privilege, whatever you want. It worked out in the end. I'm still here, still out there. And that kind of brings us all to the Insomniac Secret Cinema. And you know, Dave, the thing I like the best about it, amongst many things, is it's bringing people together. I see you there. I think the one thing I can take away from it, and I think John would agree with this too, because we talked about it not too long ago, is that we left a lot of good vibes behind. Mm-hmm. And we didn't realize it at the time, but we had been an influence on younger people. Yeah, we kind of screwed you up a little bit with some of this stuff. But
we were talking about this just before we started. Is I grew up going to Insomniac a little later in my teens because I was a Cayucas kid and I went to Cayucas Video. But whenever I'd take the bus into SLO or go with my family, but it was because of Insomniac. It was because of Cayucas Video, and it was because of all because of Video Palace where I worked. It was because of all these mom and pop places that took time to curate, took time to put up movies on the recommended wall that you would never see recommended anywhere else. And you better not let your parents see that you're renting those. But those are the movies that form not only our childhood, but our creativity. As we're kind of wrapping up here, can you tell me just a little bit about the secret cinema and what it is?
It's a secret cinema because it kind of harkens to a point we've been talking about. You come in looking for one thing, and you're surprised because there's something totally different. Take a chance. It's the Insomniacs. You kind of know what we're about. We could show you a classic. We could show you something that, you know, might make you turn green. But one of the best things I like, Dave, is the lobby after the show, people are talking to each other. And that's cool. That's good to see.
I know you have one coming up in a couple weeks, right?
Right. 7 o'clock, October 16th, which is a Thursday. We'll have our next show, and it's going to be a good one.
Bob, this was great. I hate to stop it now, but I think you need to come back. I think we need like a part deux to this.
Okay. Yeah. And we can't use subtitles here. So I'd be honored. I'd love to, Dave. Absolutely.
Bob, this was great. Thank you for hanging out with me today on Issues and Ideas. This is KCBX.
Hello, this is Gianna Patchen, and welcome to People and the Planet. People and the Planet highlights local environmental leaders and explores the interconnection between our communities and our Earth. I work as the chapter coordinator for the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club, a caveat that People and the Planet's guests do not represent the Sierra Club. And with that, I'm excited to welcome our guests, Sandy Aylesworth with the Natural Resources Defense Council, who is their director of the Pacific Initiative with the Oceans Program, and Steph Wald, executive advisor for Creeklands Conservation. The Natural Resources Defense Council is a nonprofit that uses science, policy, law, and people power to confront the climate crisis, protect public health, and safeguard nature.
Thanks so much for having me. My name's Sandy Aylesworth. I have the challenge and the privilege of getting to help try to protect the ocean every day.
And Steph, could you share a little bit more about yourself as well?
Sure. I've been with Creeklands Conservation for about 25 years and working in our local watersheds from Monterey to Ventura to improve the watersheds for people, fish, and wildlife. And we essentially have been in your backyard for many, many years, and you may not have heard of us, Creeklands Conservation.
So could you share with me a little bit more about your work, and particularly on the Point Sal Marine Protected Area campaign?
This Point Sal Marine Protected Area proposal is connected to a much broader effort. In 2020, Governor Newsom did something really bold and ambitious and signed an executive order saying that California was going to protect 30% of its lands and 30% of its oceans and coasts by 2030. And that initiative is called 30 by 30. And it's part of a global effort that addresses many scientists saying that in order to arrest the biodiversity crisis, we need to significantly ramp up land and ocean conservation on a global scale. And we need to protect 30% of representative habitats from lands and the ocean by 2030. A lot of people know about the climate crisis, but the biodiversity crisis is also something that is threatening humans. Going back to Governor Newsom, he was the first U.S. state to sign itself up and say that we were going to ramp up conservation in California. And with that, it kicked off the 30 by 30 initiative in California. And that happened to coincide with the once in a decade 10-year management review of California's Marine Protected Area Network. And I'm getting a little bit in the weeds here, but I will take a step back and say California has an incredible network of 124 marine protected areas. I'll call them MPAs. And written into the statute that helped establish those marine protected areas, the legislators were really smart in saying every decade we're going to take a look at our entire marine protected area network and see whether or not it's meeting the goals of our legislation. And the 30 by 30 initiative coincided with the first ever 10-year adaptive management process of the MPA network. And so the Fish and Game Commission said that it was okay for members of the public to submit proposals for potentially changes to the MPA network. And there are proposals to strengthen the network, and there are proposals that might weaken the network. NRDC spent about a year looking at the entire coast of California, and we were looking for really special places that we thought merited additional protections. And Point Sal rose to the top of that list. And so that is the genesis of this Point Sal proposal.
That is really exciting. I think that marine protected areas on our central coast are really important. As you know, it's a biodiversity hotspot off of our coast here. But to broaden and expand our audience's knowledge, could you explain what a marine protected area is?
So marine protected areas are areas where marine ecosystems and wildlife have a chance to recover and thrive because they are not feeling the impacts of harmful activities on the ocean, some of which are things like oil and gas or commercial fishing, say, an aquaculture facility or desalination plant.
Could you share a bit about like the scope we're talking about when we're proposing a marine protected area of size, but also impacts beyond the borders of a marine protected area?
Great question. California's marine protected areas, I would say, are really special because relative to the size of the ocean, they're actually quite small. But because they were designed very carefully according to scientific guidelines, they're a set distance apart from each other. And so they're actually connected to each other through larval connectivity. So for this Point Sal proposal, for example, the area is about 14 square miles. We happened to be on a hike today, Steph and I, and we got to behold the entire marine protected area just looking out into the ocean. And so, again, compared to, you know, the enormous scale of the ocean, it's a relatively small area. But what's spectacular about them is they're these biodiversity hotspots, like you said, and they allow for fish, especially the older female fish, to grow much larger. And as a female fish matures, she's able to increase her egg production exponentially, creating what's called a spillover effect. And this is something that is well documented in California's marine protected areas, where lobstermen in particular have seen these incredible spillover benefits from the marine protected areas in the Channel Islands. If you travel to, say, Anacapa Island, you'll see lobster pots just lining the boundaries of the MPAs because you have these older, really fecund adults that are producing, and then they have, you know, their juveniles that are able to grow, and then they gradually walk offshore where the lucky lobsterman can secure a mature lobster that they can then keep. There are marine protected areas in California that have been a big boon for certain dive companies because those dive companies preferentially choose to dive in those marine protected areas because you see much richer, bigger, more abundant wildlife.
So speaking of community impacts of implementing a marine protected area, I'm curious with the Point Sal Marine Protected Area campaign and proposal, could you share more about why Point Sal and how community voices and leaders like Steph have been included in the process of advocating for this marine protected area?
What's been so special about working on this Point Sal proposal is that we looked at it, we kind of examined it from a scientific perspective, and I can talk about sort of the scientific reasons behind it. But what we discovered when we actually started connecting with people in the local community is this is something, this is a special area that many people in Guadalupe and Santa Maria have been interested in conserving for nearly four decades. And so it's been, I would say, the most rewarding and fun part of this process to get to connect with, say, the Sierra Club and the Dune Center and Creeklands Conservation and other local organizations. But I will say that we have spoken to members of some tribes that have talked about the importance of the Point Sal area to them for cultural and spiritual reasons. The Guadalupe Business Association is really exploring the potential for ecotourism in the area and is seeing this proposal as a possible business opportunity to bring people to the area and really take in the wildlife that you can see on Lion Rock, for example. And then a really powerful example for me that hits close to home because of my background working with kids is that the Dune Center takes local school groups out and they have hiking club. And the kids go hike and learn about the natural world. And even though some of those kids may not be up for the 12-mile round-trip hike to Point Sal, I think it's like through getting to connect with the ocean and sort of come to learn about marine protected areas that you have kids that can sort of grow to become conservation leaders and feel really connected to the place where they live.
If you're just joining us, this is Issues and Ideas, and I'm your host, Gianna Patchen. Today, I'm talking with Sandy Aylesworth from the Natural Resources Defense Council and Steph Wald, Executive Advisor for Creeklands Conservation. Yeah. Sandy, do you have anything you want to add?
Marine protected areas are critical for our future stewards of planet Earth on the Central Coast. Getting kids out there is essential. Creeklands Conservation also has education programs like the Dune Center. And we have Trout in the Classroom, where kids actually get to raise small, you know, eggs into trout and release those trout into our local landlocked bodies of water and figure out how this part of nature works. And a marine protected area is critical for this because it's where fish can become, again, a larger portion of our resources that need to be protected. And we're here to help NRDC to do that in this case.
Getting kids outside and experiencing nature, feeling part of it, is so crucial in my opinion as well.
I forgot to talk about another benefit, perhaps the most important benefit, which is to the ocean and just the reward that comes with protecting a special place. When Steph and I were out there hiking today, it was magnificent to see all of the animals that were playing and roosting and feeding around Lion Rock. And we were able to see probably a dozen seals that were just surfing in the waves out by Point Sal. And then you could also see a lot of animal protein and signs of kind of active animal life on the lee side of Point Sal, which is kind of its defining ecological feature, is that it is this larval retention zone where it protects juvenile fish. And you could see that it is much calmer on that side of the point. And you can tell there's been quite a few animals that are sort of enjoying the break from the wind and the waves on that side of the point. And then we were able to see three breaching humpback whales all along, yeah, just from the ridge. And so it's just thrilling to think about a place like that being protected in perpetuity from, you know, future stressors that could impact the coast.
Can we do a nerdy moment?
Yeah, let's hear a nerdy moment.
So we've been saying this word larva, L-A-R-V-A, for you listeners out there. What the heck is a larva? I'll tell you. A larva is an early life stage of many of our fish in the ocean. And, you know, they can't see each other. They just literally are drifting in the water. So it's really important that these larvae have a large protected area to drift in and be protected from some of the natural and human-oriented stressors that exist. If we don't have a marine protected area, then these larvae essentially will be used in other ways, other food for other animals out there. But in the marine protected area, there's a little extra protection for them. And the larvae can find each other and grow into larger organisms that feed us and, of course, feed wildlife.
Could you share an example of like what starts a couple animals that start as a larva that we maybe know of?
Almost everything in the ocean starts that way, you know, starts as an egg usually, and then it will be fertilized by the opposite, usually sex, but not always. Sometimes they don't need fertilization and they can become a fully formed organism without that. But the larva is sort of the free-floating, somewhat swimming, not always swimming, somewhat sometimes swimming. But most of the time, the current has the higher force of nature rather than any kind of force this really tiny organism has. I was going to say abalone have larvae. Fish have, you wouldn't call them larvae. You might call them fingerlings, would be a small fish. But I think the point is not necessarily the animal. So the point,
yeah,
going to take us to a higher place and say that this larval action is, it's almost like a circulatory system for the marine environment to move these early life forms closer and in contact with each other so that reproduction can happen.
Could you share a little bit about what it was like to nominate Point Sal Marine Protected Area and like what is this process that our communities can go through to designate a marine protected area in our backyard?
We know that California has about 21% of its state waters protected, so we need an additional 9%. And we may not get to the additional 9% through marine protected areas. However, adding these really special sort of pockets of biodiversity in protected, strongly protected waters could be really beneficial. As I mentioned, in 2022, there was this executive order that was saying that California needed to add new ocean protections. At that time, California had about 16% of its state waters protected, meaning we need to add an additional 500,000 acres. Since then, we have boosted that number to 21%. In the intervening time, because of the decadal management review process and this adaptive management process that we're going through, the Fish and Game Commission, in very close coordination with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, said to members of the public, you can submit proposals to make changes to the marine protected area network. So that was when NRDC really put its head down and was poring over maps and talking to dozens of scientists and looking for special places that we should protect. And we have from now until the Fish and Game Commission votes on the proposal to gather as much local support as we can. So what's really going to give this proposal a fighting chance of winning or being approved by the Fish and Game Commission is getting as much support from the local community as we can get. So if you're someone who's excited about this proposal, it would be phenomenal if you would sign a letter of support.
If you are interested in learning more about the marine protected area, specifically the Point Sal Marine Protected Area, you can email us at sierraclub8@gmail.com and we'll connect you with Sandy and Steph and myself and help you learn how to use your voice in this process. We can't emphasize enough how much community voices play a role in determining if these marine protected areas get implemented or not. So we need all y'all to join us in standing up to protect all the larvae here on our Central Coast. This is Issues and Ideas. I'm Gianna Patchen, and you're listening to People and the Planet.
Hello, I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local author and entrepreneur Mike Miner discussing his new book, Heroes, Rogues, and Wisdom, A 20th Century American Family History. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
My grandparents played an unusually significant role in my life for a multitude of reasons. And when they died, I'd always consoled myself that, well, as long as I'm around, I can tell stories about them and keep them alive. It suddenly occurred to me as I'm advancing into my own old age that that's not going to work. And so my grandparents are going to be in real trouble once I'm no longer here. And it just seemed such a shame because they were such interesting characters.
To sort of keep them alive. And
exactly.
Do you think, I have my own strong feelings about the topic, but family histories, what would be the rationale for writing it down? Would it be for your own family or possibly a wider audience?
At first, it was just for my family. And the first draft of this book was very different from this final version. And my brother read it, and his advice was, you should weave the 20th century into this. And at first I just went, are you kidding me? That's just so going to be so difficult. But eventually I said, no, I think you're right. And so I rewrote it with the idea of what's in this for the reader.
Yeah.
If this is going to appeal to a wider audience, it's got to be more interesting than just stories about my grandparents.
And we're just a couple years apart in age, and I was amazed when my grandparents were born, late 1890s. It was still horse and buggy time,
right.
And then they lived to see a man landing on the moon. I'm guessing there hasn't been a human generation ever with that amount of change.
That's certainly my take on it. As it turns out, I actually have a degree in history. Let me tell you, there's a lot of history out there.
Oh, yeah.
just consider the Chinese civilization goes back 4,000 years. The U.S. doesn't even go back 400 years. So there's a lot to choose from. But in my appreciation of history or understanding of history, there is no period that rises to the level of the 20th century in the USA. It is absolutely the most amazing century in the history of the world, without question.
You know, one of the things, we're going to dive into your book here in a second, but one of the things that struck me was about your relatives was the resilience they showed in hard work and misfortune, changing circumstances. You know, as it was just all routine, and the amount of courage and grace, those two things which I admire so much in the human psyche, it's just astounding.
But I don't think my grandparents were particularly unusual in that regard. I think that was the culture in the early 1900s. And a lot of it was, there was no safety net. There was no Social Security and workers' comp and unemployment and the rest of it. You either made it work or you died.
Yeah.
It was very clear how this was going to end. Either you were going to succeed or you were going to die.
So your family history starts in, if I can use the term loosely, with a smile, a garden paradise of South Dakota.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, that was where my grandfather was born and where my great-grandfather first filed a homestead claim. And that's where the story takes up. And it's hard to imagine any place more rural than South Dakota. Even today, it's just, there's nothing there.
An interesting tidbit in the book is there's an actual county named for your family.
There is. Digress for just a moment on that. Go back in time to my great-great-grandfather. As it turns out, he was quite a character. And if I may, I'll just read a quick section on this. So a returning home in 1865, Nelson spent the next 4 years serving as registrar of the only land office in the Dakota Territory. He donated land and helped build the first permanent school in the territory. Then, in 1869, along with his brother Ephraim, he was selected to the territorial legislature. Together, they served with enough distinction to get Minor County, South Dakota, named in their honor. It was an impressive list of accomplishments, although, to be honest, the bit about distinction is somewhat speculative. The fact that Ephraim owned the local brothel and eventually died from syphilis does give one pause.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was the next journey of your family?
Well, on that side of the family, they in 1910, after my grandfather succeeded in the homestead part of the regime, he got his claim and then was able to sell the property and make some money on it, which as far as I could tell was his plan all along. He didn't want to live there. And so he took the family as far west as they could go, which at that time would have been the train station into Anaheim, California. There was the Union Pacific went all the way to New York, and then there was a side spur that went off down to Anaheim. So that's where they landed. And again, even though South Dakota was rural, even by today's standards, when you looked at Southern California at this time, it was extremely rural. Once you got out of L.A. proper, it was all sagebrush and rolling hills and farmland. And as it turns out, my other grandfather, my immigrant grandfather, that's where he landed as well, was in Anaheim, and worked for a ranching or a farming operation at that time.
Were they business people or farming? Did they get back into farming?
The minor side of the family, he was always a business guy. The other side of my grandmother's side, the Swedish side, the Swedish immigrant side, he was always a farmer. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, my grandmother, who we follow through the whole story, the last thing that she was actively doing was tending to her garden in the backyard.
I'd like to remind everyone, I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today, we're joined by a local entrepreneur and author, Mike Miner, to discuss his new family history book called Heroes, Rogues, and Wisdom. When did the two families, the Swedish side and the Miner side, let's talk about that.
My grandfather, the South Dakota guy, he's I think, 6 years old when he arrives, and when the family arrives in what was then, or is now, Berea, the town of Berea. And just below that, the bordering town today is Placentia. And that's where my grandmother lived. They didn't know each other at all growing up, but later, my grandfather's about, I think he's 22, and he's out to get his first business license. And he walks into the city of Placentia to acquire this certificate that he needs to open his business. And the lady behind the counter is the acting city clerk, which is my grandmother, B, who was 19 at the time. And as I write in the book, Abe was immediately smitten. And she was a very attractive young woman, and unusually intelligent, and unusually just vibrant, just a positive force. And I can see why he would have been drawn to her. She was an amazing.
Do you think
person.
It was mutual, or was he? Did he pursue her, or how did that play out?
It's a good question. I don't. I have a hard time imagining that my grandfather Abe was all that
romantic. Maybe.
Right. I don't. I'm not sure that in B's case.
And her name was Bernice, right?
Her name was Bernice. Everyone called her B. And and that's all how I ever knew her. Her children and her grandchildren all called her B, as did all her friends and other relatives. Tragically, B's father had just died about 6 months previously, and so B, who had been a college student, which was incredible at that time, and less than 5% of the female population went on to college, but B was there, and then had to drop out, and so
to go to work
to help support the family, and so I'm speculating here. She had to be looking at limited options, and Abe certainly was a talker. This guy could sell ice cubes to Eskimos, like almost literally.
Yeah, capitalist to the core. I'm thinking
he was extraordinary.
Well, she sounds. I would use the term vivacious or magnetic. You know, she obviously had a presence.
She did.
You know,
she
as
really
a human
did.
Being and of kindness, and I still can't get over the. Concept of cooking a different meal for every single grandchild. I don't think I've ever heard of such a thing.
We all thought it was normal. what you're referring to for the listeners is later in the book. In the 60s, myself and my two siblings and our two cousins would typically arrive at Ava and B's house on Friday night. I'm sorry, Saturday night, go have an adventure and then go home. But so B is faced with these five, little grandchildren, all of whom, with the notable exception of myself, are extremely picky eaters. And nobody could decide on what they wanted to eat. So B's solution was, she just cooked five different meals. And we all thought that was normal.
How about another reading, another selection?
Yeah, this is talking about B, and she was born in 1904. Remarkably, and this is a quote from the book, remarkably, B would live to see her 96th birthday, which means that the remainder of the 20th century unfolded right before her eyes. As a little girl living in the country, she'd taken her first airplane ride when a barnstormer landed his biplane in a nearby field. She watched her oldest brother go off to fight in France during World War I, and watched again as her oldest son enlisted in the Navy during World War II. She lived through the Great Depression and the Great Society. She grew up when the family car was a horse and buggy and lived to see spacecraft exit the solar system. She saw Halley's Comet twice.
Wow.
It really is a wow. Nobody in my generation can ever say stuff like that.
Tell us about the time Abe Minor was a minor.
Yeah. Abe early on could recognize a paradigm shift before most anybody else could. And so... The 1930s were tough. It's the Great Depression. He's lost his last, which was by far his best and most successful business. He had a nationwide distribution company, and his partner, basically went crazy and literally killed himself and took the secret formula with him, and the company collapsed overnight. So Abe is in a desperate situation. They're living at this time. The family's living in Atlanta, Georgia, and it's a storybook existence. I mean, they've got a maid, they've got this magnificent home, they've got this. You know, he's not a billionaire or anything like that, but he's on his way to really making a lot of money. And then it all collapses overnight. He recognizes, this is the late 30s, that World War II is imminent, or discovers, rather, that the War Department has categorized manganese as a strategic item. 98% of it is iron, and about 1% is manganese. And manganese is what makes steel hard. You have to have it to make anything out of steel. And so Abe finds this manganese mine in the Mojave Desert, which is the meanest, nastiest place on the planet, and moves the whole family there. And that's where they live for all of World War II. And he's mining manganese.
I just I have to say, I mean, not only is it sort of a wild and crazy thing, but he made a go of it. And you all, I mean, your dad and uncle, they worked so hard, and your grandma. I can't imagine such an existence in such a harsh environment. It's just a little bit beyond belief.
It really is. And of course, as growing up, I would hear these stories from my grandparents and from my dad and my uncle. And honestly, I'd go, I must be adopted. there's just no way I could ever do this.
Any final thoughts as we wrap up? What would you like to convey to people who might read this book and why it's important to read it?
I don't know if it's important to read it. I'd like to think it certainly will hold your interest. I've gotten a surprising amount of feedback, and I've got letters and phone calls and emails and stuff. And the people have different parts resonate with different people. You had mentioned before we went on air about you could see your parents in some of this. I've had other people talk about, oh, yeah, I remember my grandfather did something similar, or my uncle went off to World War II, and so on. So it connects people to their own history and helps them remember that these people that came before us all led rich and interesting lives, if we can just take the time to ferret some of that out.
It's just so important. In psychology, they call it a sense of place. You know your history, you know where the resources in town are, and then that leads to what I call self-efficacy, where you're resilient. You know, you can flourish in your area better because you know its history, you know the context. I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by local entrepreneur and author Mike Miner, discussing his family history book, fascinating book, which I highly recommend, Heroes, Rogues, and Wisdom, A 20th Century American Family History. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, Public Radio for the Central Coast. Our theme music comes from Gary Eister, and a big thank you to all of our guests and contributors. I'm David McAbee. Join me every Monday from 1 to 2 for more stories, more voices, and more of what makes our community tick. And if you miss something or just want to hear it again, you'll find every conversation waiting for you at kcbx.org. And remember, the best stories are right here at home. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. This is KCBX.